What kind of impact has recently deceased Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez had on the people of Venezuela and on the world? And what evidence is there that his recent death may have been part of a Washington-directed assassination attempt? On the occasion of his recent state funeral, we'll spend most of the hour discussing this question with someone who has advised the government and met Chavez in person, Professor Michelle Chalsadovsky of the Center for Research on Globalization. And also, with tensions flaring in the Korean Peninsula, does the aggressive posturing by North Korean leader Kim Jong-un reflect threats from an unstable rogue regime, or is it understandable in the face of recent and historic actions from the U.S.? Writer and political analyst Gregory Ellich will put the Korean situation in context for us later in the hour. On today's program, The Legacy of Chavez and the Korean Powder Keg. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of March 14th, 2013. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also now be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We'll begin our show with some of the major stories shaping the national and international political landscape. According to a U.S. Treasury Department document, the Obama administration is planning to allow U.S. spy agencies access to a massive database containing financial information of Americans and others who do business with the nation's banks. The yet-to-be-implemented planning document, dated March 4th, represents a major step by U.S. intelligence agencies to monitor crime syndicates and terrorist networks. Under the plan, agencies such as the Central Intelligence Agency and the National Security Agency would have access to more raw financial data than ever before, assisting them in establishing patterns which would reveal attack plots or criminal schemes. Financial institutions are required by law to log reports of suspicious customer activity, such as cash transfers of over $10,000, to the Treasury's Financial Crimes Enforcement Network, or FinCEN. Privacy watchdogs have raised concerns, however, that applying the plan could ensnare people innocent of terrorist activity, leaving them vulnerable to being falsely accused. That comes to us from Reuters. According to state media, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un has informed his frontline military forces to prepare for the possibility of a war. North Korea told troops stationed near disputed waters that war could break out at any moment. It is saying the armistice that ended the Korean War has been scrapped and is threatening a preemptive nuclear strike against the United States. Officials in the South pointed out that calls to the North through the North-South hotline went unanswered earlier this week. Some communications channels, such as the military line, which coordinates the border crossing run to the jointly run Kaesong Industrial Complex, has been used. Analysts believe Kim Jong-un's statements are likely intended to express more than anger over the new round of sanctions and over the joint military drills involving the United States and South Korea. The relatively young and inexperienced North Korean leader is likely also trying to shore up domestic support at home. That comes to us from The Guardian. The acting president of Venezuela, Nicolas Maduro, has openly speculated that his predecessor's untimely death may have been the result of poisoning from foreign enemies and announced that he would launch an investigation into those sorts of claims. Chavez was diagnosed with pelvic cancer in 2011 and underwent four operations before ultimately dying from what sources called metastasis in the lungs. Maduro, a former bus driver and Chavez's hand-picked successor, has been running in an at times acrimonious election campaign with opposition leader Capriles in the lead-up to an April 14th election. The two candidates are accusing each other of planning violence. Tuesday marked the last day of official mourning for Chavez. His embalmed remains are to be taken to a military museum on Friday, and that comes to us from Reuters. As newly selected Pope Francis steps forth as the next leader of the world's 1.2 billion Roman Catholics, his background is coming under scrutiny. The Argentine Catholic Church is being accused of being tacitly complicit in the brutal murders that typified the dictatorship which governed the country from 1976 to 1983. A court which sentenced three former military officers last month also noted that the church hierarchy closed its eyes to the killing of progressive priests. The new pope, Jorge Bergoglio, was head of the Jesuit order from 1973 to 1979 and part of that hierarchy which backed the military junta and called its followers to be patriotic. Journalist Horacio Verbitsky, author of the book El Silencio, accused Bergoglio of withdrawing his order's protection from two priests who were conducting missionary work in the country's slums and consequently jailed and subjected to inhumane conditions by the regime. Pope Francis will be Latin America's first pope. That comes to us from The Guardian. Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez Frias was laid to rest last week. Millions of Venezuelans, Cubans, and people around the world paid homage to his memory. Representatives of 50 governments, including 33 heads of state, attended his funeral on March 8th. Meanwhile, the U.S. President and Canadian Prime Minister could offer only tepid sentiments and sympathy with the Venezuelan people, expressing hopes of quote-unquote policies that promote democratic principles. Chavez personalized popular policies that defied foreign interests many Western leaders protected. Michel Chossudovsky, he has been an economic advisor to developing countries around the world, including Venezuela. He is the founder of the Center for Research on Globalization, and he joins us on the phone to share with us his thoughts about the impact of Chavez, both for the people and the larger regional and global picture. So, Michel Chossudovsky, thank you very much for joining us.
Pleasure to be on the program.
Okay, so Professor Chossudovsky, I suppose it should be pointed out that you've actually met with you've conducted some of your early research in Venezuela, correct?
Well, in fact, I spent my earlier part of my career in Venezuela. I was an advisor to the Ministry of Planning, and in that particular context, I put together a working group which was to study poverty in Venezuela. That was in the mid-70s, and it was during the government of Carlos Andrés Pérez, and it was precisely those governments, Acción Democrática, COPE, which were targeted by the People's Movement, by Hugo Chavez at a very early period. I think, from my standpoint, there's a sort of historical understanding of what has happened, and I think that's important. Venezuela was essentially a colony of the United States during the dictatorship of Juan Vicente Gomez. It was an oil economy controlled by the major oil companies. It was a territory, and what they did is they installed dictators, Juan Vicente Gomez and then Pérez Jiménez. And subsequently, then you had the emergence of a two-party system, which essentially continued to pursue the interests of the oil companies, of the Rockefellers, of Wall Street, and so on, in alliance with the local elites. I witnessed this process at a very crucial time. We came up with this study in the 70s, and literally the poverty indicators were absolutely devastating. Three quarters of the population were undernourished. 20% of children never got to school. Only one third of the children who registered at the schools actually completed primary education. Illiteracy was rampant. There was no electricity for large sectors of the population, no water. We documented this very carefully. And what happened is the report was then confiscated by the cabinet of President Carlos Andrés Pérez at the time, and subsequently I brought it out as a book. I mention this because this was the project for Venezuela of the United States of America. It was to extract the oil wealth, share some of it with the local elites, very wealthy, very wealthy property-owning classes, a small middle class, and essentially leave the entire population in a state of poverty. That is the background, and that is the basis of the Bolivarian Revolution. The whole thrust of Hugo Chavez and his commitment was to essentially channel the oil resources towards improving the standard of living of the Venezuelan population. And in that regard, I mean, the indicators are very revealing. They're extremely revealing because they show how, in a matter of, he was president during 14 years. I should also mention that he was elected president. He won all those elections he won, with the exception of one. And he, in other words, he had popular support. Now, the irony is the United States will come up and say, well, we want democracy. What did they do for Venezuela? They installed dictators, okay? Mm-hmm. And then they installed proxy regimes, which were corrupt, etc. And here we have a president who was elected, who had popular support, and who implemented a whole series of changes in the national economy. But I think, above all, Washington resented Hugo Chavez because Hugo Chavez actually started to initiate projects at the level of Latin America where governments would join hands and take a stance against Washington, and this hadn't happened. It went a little bit against the whole notion of the Monroe Doctrine, which was saying Americans are the Americans, but which essentially meant United States controls the hemisphere. And there you had a president who started establishing alliances with other countries in the region, including countries which weren't necessarily socialist, but the whole issue of sovereignty was behind that.
There was a long history of throughout Latin America. I mean, one country after the other was being dominated by these foreign interests.
Well, absolutely. I started my career in Latin America. I was in Chile during the coup, and I lived through the both through the Allende period and the dictatorship, and then subsequently I was in Argentina and lived through another coup in 76. Now, all these coups were instigated by the CIA. We know that. Henry Kissinger was behind the coup in Chile. Allende was assassinated. So we've got a long history, and we can go back to Central America, how they ultimately destabilized a working democracy in Guatemala, and then initiated what was referred to the Salvador option, which was creating death squads, which would go in and kill people, and ultimately sustain the dictatorships or alternatively sustain proxy regimes which were under some kind of democratic facade, which is the fashionable modus operandi today. Is you say we're in favor of democracy, and then you install a president who is ultimately obeying orders from Washington. But I mean, I saw this happening when I lived in Peru. There was a progressive movement within the armed forces. It wasn't particularly a democratic parliamentarian type of process, but the United States didn't want to have anything to do with it. They destabilized it. And then again in the 1980s, what was it? It was the rule of the IMF and the World Bank. Mm. Now, Chavez defied all those things. And in other words, he defied neoliberalism. He defied the imposition of the Washington consensus, and he did it with the support of large sectors of the population, not only in Venezuela but throughout the hemisphere.
And he was also able to defy Washington on many levels. There was a coup attempt in 2002, and then there was a counter coup in which he was able to prevail. And then I seem to recall another incident where there was the major corporations staged a lockout, and still the people backed Chavez through all of that. No,
well, absolutely. That I think there were several attempts to destabilize Chavez throughout that period, which failed. And this government has faced very, very difficult circumstances. I went back to Venezuela several times. I met Chavez a few years back. The structure of the state did not fundamentally change. In other words, the working of the ministries, the system of allocating contracts, public works, so that he wasn't able to actually sort of restructure the whole state apparatus, and so that they were operating in a sort of a dual mode. You had educational programs that would go through the Ministry of Education, and then you had educational programs that were grassroots based, and the same thing for healthcare. And people realized that this was still a very corrupt system. You had a situation which still prevails today of complete insecurity in Caracas. You can't walk the streets at night. Why? Because there are armed gangs linked to the drug trade. Most probably this is also a staged type of process, but it created a lot of resentment, particularly in the nation's capital, by the middle class against Chavez. And the problem is that you don't transform this kind of despotic capitalist economy from one day to the next and change the structure of the state and so on. And so there was a very big battle to be waged. There was a fair amount of corruption even within the Bolivarian movement. I think we have to acknowledge it. And I think Chavez knew about it, and he was very pragmatic. He made alliances with people who ensured certain level of political stability within the armed forces. Day-to-day policy was absolutely essential to keep the system functioning. But there are many, many contradictions, and one fears that in the wake of his passing, certainly the United States is planning to destabilize.
That sounds critical, because if I'm following you correctly, it sounds like what you're saying is that he maintained that kind of caliphate of control, but instead of favoring the corporations and filling his own pockets, he was just using it for the people. But that same sort of corrupt, violent character of the state maintained its grip.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I think it's very important for us to follow very carefully what's going to happen in the months ahead. I think there's a very big commitment on the part of the population to make this process continue. And indeed, the process, it's not Chavez that determines this process. It's ultimately still a grassroots process which is occurring, and it as I mentioned, it has changed the livelihood of many, many people in that country. They've resolved the problem of illiteracy. There was widespread illiteracy in the 70s and 80s. They've resolved the issue
university tuition.
Well, the whole educational system has been turned upside down. I mentioned to you that out of 100 kids of primary school age, 20% don't enter school, and only one-third of those who enter, in other words, the 80 who do enter, only one-third of them actually finish primary school. That was the situation in the late 70s. Now, today, according to UNESCO, the number of children attending school increased from 6 million in 1998 to 13 million in 2011. It almost doubled, and that school enrollment rate is now almost 100%. So the project was essentially to channel oil resources to building social and economic infrastructure in areas of health, education. There were very significant increases in the levels of health, with a focus on grassroots healthcare. The Cubans, of course, contributed tremendously to that process, sending in doctors. I recall when I started up analyzing poverty. I mean, the situation of access to healthcare was virtually nil on the part of the poor, maybe 50 or 60% of the population didn't have access to healthcare. And the number of doctors per thousand population was dismal. I mean, in the 90s, there were 20 doctors for 100,000 population. The latest figures indicate that number has gone up four times. Okay, mm-hmm. 80 doctors for 100,000 population, which is still not sufficient, but there's been a marked improvement in all those social indicators. Malnutrition, the infant mortality. I mean, when we started investigating infant mortality and the role of infectious diseases, the figures were just devastating. I mean, I worked with a professor at the university, was a nutritionist, and who looked into the whole issue. We came up with figures. As I mentioned, 77% of the population was below the minimum calorie and protein requirements. Those were our estimates. I went to the university. I said, this sounds absolutely, very, very high. I asked this top specialist, who was actually, he was not particularly a progressive individual, but he was a very committed scientist. And he said, yes, you're right. He said, whatever we've estimated corroborates what you've got there. Now, today in Venezuela, that situation has been turned upside down. And had it not been for the Bolivarian Revolution led by Hugo Chavez, Venezuela would still be this poor, marginalized country. Very much similar to other countries in the region, like the Dominican Republic or Mexico, where you have these high levels of poverty and unemployment, and they managed. These are achievements amidst lots of contradictions. It's not necessarily a revolution, but it's a process which cannot be denied, and it also is something which the United States cannot deny, because those figures are there.
Professor Chossudovsky, speaking of those contradictions, I just want to kind of nail this point. Given your experience with the country and the population, there's tremendous devotion to Chavez. And I guess I think we really need to ask that critical question. Is this devotion to that popular self-determination kind of governance, or is it more the devotion towards a benevolent dictator who, if you will, that's brought these changes about?
Chavez was a very important figure, and he certainly had, he was also what Latin Americans call the caudillo, you know, the leader. But he was from very humble background. He communicated on a equal footing with people. He never tried to, he'd meet people, there was a dialogue. He comes from the interior of Venezuela, and of a very modest background. He's not a white European, you know. He really is. He represents the people of the country, and I think people realize that. Okay, mm-hmm. He doesn't look down on people. Okay,
no.
Which if you're talking about the cult of personality, there's that look down type of behavior, but the popularity of Hugo Chavez is the fact that he put himself at the same level as everybody else. Not to say that he didn't exercise power, he did. You know, he did, and he certainly wanted to prevail in that regard. But he always respected all the rules of democracy. You can't say that he tried to fiddle anything. When President Jimmy Carter went down as an observer, he said, "Yes, this is the most democratic country on earth." He made that statement. He said, "Venezuela's electoral system was, quote, the best in the world." Now, you don't get that kind of statement even in the United States of America. Okay, so there we are. We have this. We have a U.S. president who can order extrajudicial assassinations of anybody on planet Earth, because that's what the legislation now implies, and then they claim to be a model democracy. They're not. They're some kind of democratic dictatorship in the United States of America, run mm-hmm. by Wall Street, the oil companies. It's a proxy government as well. But the whole issue is that here we have a country has challenged the hegemony of the United States in the hemisphere, and it's a very important historical process. In the same way as the Cuban Revolution challenged, the hegemony of the United States, and still challenges that hegemony, I think we have to look forward and ensure that those achievements are not lost in U.S. dirty tricks, which are probably on the drawing board of the State Department and the CIA.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcasting from CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and from partnering radio stations across the country. We're also podcast at globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. Continuing our conversation on the death of Chavez and its impacts, I brought up with Michelle Chosudovsky the question of whether Chavez may have been assassinated by Washington.
We've been talking in rather general terms about the extent to which Chavez and his Bolivarian Revolution defied the international order. Do we have very compelling evidence of that Chavez himself was actually a target of an assassination attempt?
There were reports to the effect that Chavez was on the CIA FBI list. We do not have at this stage, pending an investigation, that Chavez was actually the target of what is referred to as a scientific assassination, where poison or was inserted into his body. We know that the technology exists, that they are secret CIA weapons which allow for the triggering of cancer and heart attacks, and that has been documented.
So that's the means. We have the means.
The means are there. We published a couple of articles today on the issue of how the CIA can trigger heart attacks, but the issue of cancer is also a possibility. But what I should mention, and it's very important, that while we don't have proof specifically that he was that the cancer was caused by a CIA operation, what we do know is that there is an assassination program, and I'd like to address that very briefly. Back in the 70s, the Frank Church Committee, it was a Senate, a special select committee of the Senate. It was called the U.S. Senate Select Committee on Intelligence, and it was subsequently called the Church Committee because Senator Frank Church played a key role. And that committee was entitled Alleged Assassination Plots Involving Foreign Leaders. It essentially focused on four or five main leaders. There were other reports. There was also a report on Chile. But the Church Committee interim report focused on alleged plots to kill Patrice Lumumba of the Congo, Fidel Castro, Rafael Trujillo of the Dominican Republic, Ngo Dinh Diem of Vietnam, and René Schneider, who was assassinated, was a general who was assassinated I believe it was just before the 1970 elections. Now, that report was published in 1975. President Ford implemented what was called an executive order. It was EO 11905. It was in response to the findings of the Church Committee, and this executive order said textually that no person employed by or acting on behalf of the United States government shall engage or conspire to engage in assassination of foreign leaders. Okay, and that was that executive order was then reaffirmed by President Jimmy Carter when he came into office. And it was also reaffirmed by President Ronald Reagan in 1981 in an executive order 12333, which essentially says no person employed by or acting on behalf of the United States government shall engage in or conspire to engage in assassination. Now, what happened? In October 2001, in the wake of 9/11, President George W. Bush, following in the footsteps of his father, who was part of a CIA cabal, he was CIA director before he became president. I'm talking about his father, but George W. Bush revoked the executive order of the Reagan administration, confirmed that henceforth foreign leaders could be killed by the U.S. government
in the name of fighting terrorism.
Well, it it was formulated, it was couched in the context of the war on terrorism, but in effect, it also said we can also kill foreign leaders who support terrorism or who are state sponsors of terrorism or who are heads of state of rogue countries or rogue states. So the thing is that what happened is that with the revocation of Executive Order 12333, which confirmed the ban initially enacted by President Gerald Ford, pursuant to the findings of the Church Committee, when that was revoked, essentially the President of the United States had the green light to order the assassination of political leaders. And that was very, very clear. So that the revocation of EO 12333 gives essentially carte blanche to the President of the United States to order an assassination and to transmit those instructions to the CIA. It's not the U.S. State Department that's going to implement the assassination. It's the CIA. But then the CIA, which has been doing this kind of stuff for years, going back to the 50s in Guatemala, okay, they specialize in targeted assassinations, but they do it covertly and they don't do it with the support of the executive or the U.S. Congress. Mm-hmm. And what this revocation signifies is that the CIA receives the orders to assassinate foreign leaders, and they are themselves protected. They can't be then, you can't go after the CIA and said, well, no, you didn't have the authority to do it, because they get the instructions directly from the president. So what I derive from this analysis is that President Obama can decide whether he wants to kill a foreign leader, and then he transmits the orders to the CIA.
And no, nobody can hold him to account. He's just his will.
Nobody can hold him accountable. But now, bear in mind that with recent developments on the targeted assassination programs, which have been recently debated in the U.S. Congress, and not a single voice even within the Democratic Party have come up to say, well, no, we shouldn't give the U.S. Head of state the authority to order the extrajudicial and lawful assassination of a U.S. citizen or a foreigner on U.S. soil or anywhere in the world, because that's really what the legislation implies. It is the lawful assassination of individuals, whoever they may be, including foreign leaders. So that if we take the revocation of Executive Order 12333 by George W. Bush October 2001, plus the recent developments with regard to Obama's right to lawfully assassinate whoever he wants, we can derive from that very logically that quite a number of people are on the list. Now, it doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to be assassinated, but they're on a list. And I've no doubt that Hugo Chavez, from the information we have, was on an assassination list.
A deadly combination, to be sure. I wanted to just sort of maybe, if we could conclude a little bit. We're looking forward. This Maduro is Chavez's successor, will be going into the next election against a right-wing challenger. I'm wondering now, with Chavez gone, what the future looks like in terms of not just for the country but for the world picture. Are we able to sort of project forward in terms of is this going to lead to a strengthening of resistance, or is it going to lead to a more easy control by the United States and Western forces?
Well, this is a very important question. If we look at the situation globally, we see that the United States is involved in destabilizing countries which do not conform to their agenda. That's the situation which prevails in Syria, the attacks pertaining to Iran, North Korea. In other words, countries which do not toe the line, they are the target of regime change. There's no question that as far as Venezuela is concerned, there is an intent in the wake of Chavez to destabilize that country. They've even insinuated this in their various statements. Okay, that they're expecting greater cooperation, etc., etc. The leading opposition figure, Capriles, has been going back and forth to Washington in the last few weeks, and he's, you know, meeting up with the State Department, the National Endowment for Democracy, and so on. So that there is a scenario of attempting to destabilize Venezuela after Chavez. There's no doubt about that. And the question of transition will be the political transition will be used by Washington to implement that process.
Okay. Well, Michel Chossudovsky, I really thank you for those perspectives on this passing of Hugo Chavez. And we'll just have to look forward and see how things unravel. So thank you again for your analysis.
Thank you very much. Delighted to be on the program.
And we've been speaking with Michel Chossudovsky, founder of the Center for Research on Globalization and a emeritus professor of economics at the University of Ottawa.
A new round of UN sanctions were leveled against North Korea in response to its recent nuclear test. Responding to the sanctions, as well as to military drills being conducted by the South and the US, the North has been threatening to cut off hotlines to the South and scrap the armistice, which ended the Korean War in 1953. Western governments and media have tended to portray the North as unstable and a threat. How accurate is this depiction? To put the Korean situation in a historical context, we are joined by Gregory Ellich. Mr. Ellich is on the board of directors of the Yasenovats Research Institute and sits on advisory boards for the Korean Truth Commission and the Korean Policy Institute. He has written extensively on North Korea and is the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit.
Greg, there have been allegations out there about the threat posed by North Korea and the prospect of him potentially using a nuclear weapon against U.S. Interests or South Korean interests. I'm wondering if there's some way that we can help understand that where the legitimate concerns that North Korea might have. Can you give us a little bit of a historical context?
Sure. As usual, the mainstream media leave out context when they present issues like this. But context is essential for understanding what's going on right now. The first thing to understand is that during the Korean War, the U.S. bombed and wiped out every single North Korean city, killed over 2 million North Koreans. So that memory of that experience is still very much alive in the minds of North Koreans. Ever since then, the North Korea has been under sanctions, severe sanctions by the U.S. In fact, it's the most heavily sanctioned nation in the world. During the Bush administration, there were a series of six-party talks on nuclear disarmament, but each time an agreement was reached, the U.S. Undermined it by imposing sanctions or freezing bank accounts, North Korean bank accounts, and so on. So we ended up with it at an impasse once again. So North Korea saw what was happening in Iraq with the invasion, and they saw later on what happened with Libya, which had given up its nascent nuclear weapons program. And in both cases, the U.S. invaded or supported armed uprising. And so it's clear that there's a definite power imbalance between the U.S. And North Korea, and its only real defense is to develop nuclear weapons. So it proceeded full bore on developing nuclear weapons. Back in December 12th, they launched a peaceful satellite into space, and the U.S. responded by pushing through U.N. sanctions against North Korea. And one thing to point out about the satellite launch is that the International Outer Space Treaty says that all nations have the right to exploration of space, and this is a direct quote, without discrimination of any kind. So North Korea was just exercising its natural international rights by launching this satellite. And the U.S. claimed that this is a ballistic missile test, but this is a very light missile, totally inappropriate for weapons use. And the missile had followed a sharp turn course in order to avoid flying over Taiwan and the Philippines, which is something that's totally inappropriate for a ballistic missile test if you're trying to test it as a weapon. Nevertheless, the U.S. pushed through its sanctions, including the most important part, putting a freeze on certain bank transactions with North Korea, and also the North Korean space program. The other part of the thing to keep in mind is that there's actually been a whole series of aggressive moves by the U.S. Back in October, they had a security consultative meeting with South Korea, in which the U.S. and South Korea developed plans for what they called a kill chain and a deterrent policy, tailored deterrence, they called it, in which case the U.S. would be involved in military clashes between South and North Korea, and there would be a wider range of scenarios that the U.S. and South Korea would be willing to use military force. And the kill chain would be the program to target North Korean missile sites even before they're in position. So it's like anticipated, like basically it's a preemptive attack. And they laid out a plan for a preemptive attack in various scenarios, including, according to the South Korean military, even in peace, in both peacetime and wartime scenarios. Mm. And there's also the fact that the U.S. Offered South Korea an exemption under the military technology control regime, which places a limit on the range of ballistic missiles. They allowed South Korea an exemption to extend the range of their ballistic missiles to cover the entire territory of North Korea. So the whole range of very aggressive actions taken against North Korea, and North Korea went ahead and conducted a nuclear test in response to the sanctions and these aggressive moves.
Which are backed by the United Nations, which begs the question, how isolated is North Korea in the wider regional context?
Well, it's quite isolated. One of the unfortunate things about the U.S. Financial pressures and sanctions is that they don't just impose sanctions. U.S. officials go to other countries, and they pressure officials in other countries to, and also of international banks, to close North Korean accounts and to not allow North Korea to open a bank on its territory or engage in a normal international trade. So there's definitely a squeezing of North Korea.
Mm. Well, what kind of threat does North Korea pose to the United States other than the ability to defend itself?
Well, that's enough of a threat, apparently. Mm-hmm. Actually, in terms of a military capability, they have a extensive armed force with conventional weapons that are mostly outmoded. As terms of nuclear weapons, they had conducted three nuclear tests. The first one was essentially a failure. The second one was a nuclear device. It wasn't a bomb. It was, and this last test was apparently of a smaller and lighter nuclear device. I don't know if it's a bomb or not, but they have a long ways to go to develop a bomb. And then, in order to put it on a missile, you have to have a missile that's capable of having a guidance system and a reentry vehicle that can withstand the heat of passing back through the atmosphere. North Korea has not developed any of that yet. And you would have to have a nuclear weapon that's small enough and light enough to put atop of a ballistic missile, and North Korea doesn't have that either. So in terms of nuclear threat, there is no nuclear threat. It's a purely conventional weapon threat. But I think that explains a lot of the rhetoric coming out of North Korea, is that they don't really have a military capability that can fend off the U.S. if the U.S. is really intent upon a military attack. So they have to try to appear to be more threatening to fend off the U.S.
What then is the end game? What is it that will finally make the U.S. Happy or satisfied at the end of all of these sanctions and military drills and whatnot? What are we looking at?
Unfortunately, we're in a feedback loop. So North Korea has always responded with negotiations when they're approached diplomatically. And that's always been a productive mode. But when they're threatened, they respond with firmness. And unfortunately, the Obama administration has steadfastly refused any negotiations whatsoever with North Korea, and has only applied pressure. So we're in a feedback loop where the U.S. imposes sanctions, North Korea responds by conducting a nuclear test, the U.S. will impose more sanctions, and there's just actually no exit routine. As far as what will satisfy the United States, there's only one thing that will satisfy the United States, and that's the overthrow of the North Korean government. And I think that's what they're aiming at through this pressure. In fact, just earlier this week, the Treasury Department imposed additional sanctions over and above the UN sanctions, where they froze assets and prohibited transactions with North Korea's main foreign exchange bank. And any international banks doing business with that will also have their will be barred from conducting business with the United States. So they're definitely trying to starve North Korea of all foreign currency and crush its economy.
Does North Korea have any kind of influence? Do they have any kind of resources or anything else that would, like, you know, Iraq, you know, one of the other countries listed by Bush as the access of evil, you know, Iraq has oil and Iran has oil. And I'm wondering what assets, you know, mineral resources or others might North Korea possess that might be part of the motivation here.
North Korea has, it's mainly mountainous. 80% of the country is mountainous, and it has a pretty fair amount of mineral resources that would be suitable for U.S. corporations to exploit. I think the main motivation is that if you assume that North Korea can be overthrown, that would allow U.S. soldiers to be placed right on the border with China and apply more pressure. So you'd have U.S. bases right on the border with China helping to encircle that nation even more.
And
so I think China is actually the real target.
Yeah, that brings up what they call the pivot. Could you maybe explain how North Korea would... I guess intersects with the plans around what they call the Asian pivot.
Yeah, well, as the U.S. is shifting its military emphasis towards Asia, and I think it's specifically with China in mind, but North Korea is used as a convenient excuse. So the U.S. is talking with nations in throughout Asia to become part of its anti-missile defense, including South Korea. They're pressuring South Korea to become part of this anti-missile defense, which is aimed supposedly at both North Korea and China, but mainly China.
So, and China has been described as being North Korea's closest ally. Are we seeing changes in that relationship?
There have been some changes. In fact, they're cutting back on trade. I just read that the seafood shipments have been cut significantly recently, and I think oil shipments have been cut too. I think a lot of this has to do with U.S. pressure. So, for instance, on the UN negotiations in the Security Council over the sanctions after the satellite launch, the U.S. threatened China that if they don't agree to these sanctions, that they're going to militarize their presence in Asia to a significantly larger degree. And I think China felt threatened by that.
Now, I was wondering what if you have any more insights into the conditions that the people of North Korea are enduring, and how that has worsened over the last I guess since Obama came into power.
As I mentioned before, it's because North Korea is 80% mountainous, it has very little arable land suitable for farming, and so they pretty much always have to import food in order to have enough to get by. And one problem they have is in a lot of their factories are closing down because they can't get spare parts. They can't get spare parts because of U.S. sanctions and pressure on international banking to block North Korea's access to foreign trade. Nevertheless, North Korea's economic situation has improved in the last few years relative to what it was, say, about 10 years ago, but it still has a long ways to go. And conditions are pretty harsh in out in the outlying areas.
I was wondering, you used the term feedback loop earlier. Do you see realistically any mechanism by which the world situation can somehow escape this, and we could see some sort of a normalization of relations between North Korea and the rest of the world community?
I think the only hope is have to come from South Korea, but unfortunately, the most recent election, Park Geun-hye was elected. She's from the conservative New Frontier Party, and I think she actually had she was giving indications of wanting to improve relations with North Korea, which was a significant improvement from her predecessor, but her party doesn't have the same opinion. I think she's under a lot of pressure from the South Korean military and others in her party to maintain a hostile relationship with North Korea. But unless she can overcome the opposition in her own party in order to improve relations, or we may have to wait 5 years for the next election in South Korea for there to be improvement. But in the foreseeable future, I don't see any way out.
Well, that's certainly a unfortunate state of affairs. But Greg Ehlich, I want to thank you very much for sharing these perspectives with us on our program.
If you don't mind, I'd like to add one more thing I meant to mention.
Of course.
Do you have time? In the negotiations over the sanctions after this latest nuclear test, the U.S. was pushing for Article 42 of Chapter 7, which would have given them military enforcement. So it would open up the prospect of a war, basically. China wouldn't go along with that, but one thing it is in the sanctions is that nations are ordered to board and inspect North Korean ships. And I think it's a very dangerous situation. We'll have to see how events develop in the days ahead.
Well, thank you for that, Greg. Gregory Ehlich is on the board of directors of the Yasanovach Research Institute, and recently appointed to the advisory board of the Korean Policy Institute, as well as sitting on the advisory board of the Korean Truth Commission. He's the author of Strange Liberators, Militarism, Mayhem, and the Pursuit of Profit. Thank you very much, Gregory Ehlich.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can hear our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across the country. We are broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.